Chapter 46. Among the heirs of Ard, as is the division of the promised land, each has to win his portion by hard fighting. The bestowal is after the manner of prophecy, and is a title without possession. To carry the map of an ungotten estate in your pocket is a poor sort of copyhold. And in fancy to cast his shoe over Eden, is little warrant that a man shall ever set the sole of his foot on an acre of his own there. The most obstinate beliefs that mortals entertain about themselves are such as they have no evidence for beyond a constant, spontaneous pulsing of their self-satisfaction as it were a hidden seed of madness, a confidence that they can move the world without precise notion of standing place or lever. "Pray go to church, Mama," said Gwendolyn the next morning. I prefer seeing Herr Klesmer alone." He had written in reply to her note that he would be with her at 11. "That is hardly correct, I think," said Mrs. Davilow, anxiously. "Our affairs are too serious for us to think of such nonsensical rules," said Gwendolyn, contemptuously. "They are insulting as well as ridiculous. You would not mind Isabel sitting with you? She would be reading in a corner." No, she could not. She would bite her nails and stare. It would be too irritating. "Trust my judgment, Mama, I must be alone. Take them all to church." Gwendolyn had her way, of course, only that Miss Mary and two of the girls stayed at home, to give the house a look of habitation, by sitting at the dining room windows. It was a delicious Sunday morning. The melancholy waning sunshine of autumn rested on the half-strown grass, and came mildly through the windows, in slanting bands of brightness over the old furniture, and the glass panel that reflected the furniture, over the tapestried chairs with their faded flower wreaths, the dark enigmatic pictures, the superannuated organ at which Gwendolyn had pleased herself with acting St. Cecilia on her first joyous arrival, the crowd of pallid, moldy knick-knacks seen through the open doors of the antecomer, whereas he had achieved the wearing of her Greek dress as Hermione. This last memory was just now very busy in her, for had not Klesmer then been struck with admiration of her pose and expression? Whatever he had said, whatever she imagined him to have thought, was at this moment pointed with keenest interest for her. Perhaps as he had never before in her life felt so inwardly dependent, so consciously in need of another person's opinion. There was a new fluttering of spirit within her, a new element of deliberation in her self-estimate which had hitherto been a blissful gift of intuition. Still it was the recurrent burden of her inward soliloquy that Klesmer had seen, but little of her, and any unfavorable conclusion of his must have too narrow a foundation. She really felt clever enough for anything. To fill up the time she collected her volumes and pieces of music, and laying them on the top of the piano, set herself to classify them. Then catching the reflection of her movements, in the glass panel, she was diverted to the contemplation of the image there and walked toward it. Dressed in black, without a single ornament, and with the warm whiteness of her skin set off between her light brown coronet of hair and her square-cut bodice, she might have tempted an artist to try again the Roman trick of a statue in black, white, and tawny marble. Seeing her image slowly advancing, she thought him beautiful not exultingly, but with grave decision. Being beautiful was after all the condition on which she most needed external testimony. If anyone objected to the turn of her nose, or the form of her neck and chin, as he had not the sense that she could presently show her power of attainment in these branches of feminine perfection. There was not much time to fill up in this way before the sound of wheels, the loud ring, and the opening doors assured her that she was not by any accident to be disappointed. This slightly increased her inward flutter. In spite of her self-confidence, she dreaded Klesmer as part of that unmanageable world which was independent of her wishes, something vitriolic, that would not cease to burn, because you smiled or frowned at it. Poor thing! She was at a higher crisis of her woman's fate than in her last experience with Grandcourt. The questioning, then, was whether she should take a particular man as a husband. The inmost fold of her questioning now was whether she need take a husband at all, whether she could not achieve substantially for herself, and no gratified ambition without bondage. Klezmer made his most deferential bow in the wide doorway of the antecomer, showing also the deference of the finest gray kerseymere trousers, and perfect gloves. The masters of those who know, are happily altogether human. Gwendolyn met him with unusual gravity, and holding out her hand said, "It is most kind of you to come, Herr Klezmer. I hope you have not thought me presumptuous. I took your wish as a command, that did me honor," said Klezmer, with answering gravity. He was really putting by his own affairs in order to give his utmost attention to what Gwendolyn might have to say, but his temperament was still in a state of excitation from the events of yesterday, likely enough to give his expressions a more than usually biting edge. Gwendolyn for once was under too great a strain of feeling to remember formalities. She continued standing near the piano, and Klezmer took his stand near the other end of it with his back to the light, and his terribly omniscient eyes upon her. No affectation was of use, and she began without delay. "I wish to consult you, Herr Klezmer. We have lost all our fortune. We have nothing. I must get my own bread, and I desire to provide for my mama, so as to save her from any hardship. The only way I can think of, and I should like it better than anything, is to be an actress, to go on the stage. But, of course, I should like to take a high position, and I thought, if you thought I could." Here Gwendolyn became a little more nervous. "It would be better for me to be a singer, to study singing also." Klezmer put down his hat upon the piano, and folded his arms, as if to concentrate himself. "I know," Gwendolyn resumed, turning from pale to pink, "and back again, know that my method of singing is very defective. But I have been ill-taught. I could be better taught. I could study. And you will understand my wish. To sing and act too, like Ricey, is a much higher position. Naturally, I should wish to take as high rank as I can. And I can rely on your judgment. I am sure you will tell me the truth." Gwendolyn somehow had the conviction that now she made this serious appeal the truth would be favorable. Still Klezmer did not speak. He drew off his gloves quickly, tossed them into his hat, rested his hands on his hips, and walked to the other end of the room. He was filled with compassion for this girl. He wanted to put a guard on his speech. When he turned again, he looked at her with a mild frown of inquiry, and said with gentle though quick utterance, "You have never seen anything, I think, of artists and their lives. I mean of musicians, actors, artists of that kind?" "Oh, no," said Gwendolyn, not perturbed by a reference to this obvious fact in the history of a young lady hitherto well provided for. "You are, pardon me," said Klezmer, again pausing near the piano and coming to a conclusion on such a matter as this, "everything must be taken into consideration. You are perhaps 20? "I am 21, said Gwendolyn, a slight fear rising in her. "Do you think I am too old?" Klezmer pouted his under lip and shook his long fingers upward in a manner totally enigmatic. "Many persons begin later than others," said Gwendolyn, betrayed by her habitual consciousness of having valuable information to bestow. Klezmer took no notice, but said with more studied gentleness than ever, "You have probably not thought of an artistic career until now. You did not entertain the notion, the longing, what shall I say? You did not wish yourself an actress, or anything of that sort, till the present trouble." "Not exactly. But I was fond of acting. I have acted. You saw me, if you remember, you saw me here in charades, and as Hermione," said Gwendolyn, really fearing that Klezmer had forgotten. "Yes, yes," he answered quickly, I remember perfectly," and again walked to the other end of the room. It was difficult for him to refrain from this kind of movement when he was in any argument, either audible or silent. Gwendolyn felt that she was being weighed. The delay was unpleasant. but she did not yet conceive that the scale could dip on the wrong side, and it seemed to her only graceful to say, "I shall be very much obliged to you for taking the trouble to give me your advice, whatever it may be." "Miss Arliff," said Klesmer, turning toward her, and speaking with a slight increase of accent, "I will veil nothing from you in this matter. I should reckon myself guilty if I put a false visage on things, made them too black or too white. The gods have a curse for him who willingly tells another the wrong road. And if I misled one who is so young, so beautiful, who, I trust, will find her happiness along the right road, I should regard myself as a Boswick." And the last word Klesmer's voice had dropped to a loud whisper. Gwendolyn felt a sinking of heart under this unexpected solemnity, and kept a sort of fascinated gaze on Klesmer's face, as he went on. "You are a beautiful young lady. You have been brought up in ease. You have done what you would you have not said to yourself, 'I must know this exactly, apostrophe, I must understand this exactly, I must do this exactly.'" In uttering these three terrible musts, Klesmer lifted up three long fingers in succession. "I, in sum, you have not been called upon to be anything but a charming young lady, whom it is an impoliteness to find fault with." He paused an instant, then resting his fingers on his hips again, and thrusting out his powerful chin, he said, "Well then, with that preparation, you wish to try the life of an artist. You wish to try a life of arduous, unceasing work, and uncertain praise. Your praise would have to be earned, like your bread, and both would come slowly, scantily. What do I say? They may hardly come at all." This tone of discouragement, which Klesmer had hoped might suffice without anything more unpleasant, roused some resistance in Gwendolyn. With a slight turn of her head away from him, and an air of pique, she said, "I thought that you, being an artist, would consider the life one of the most honorable and delightful. And if I can do nothing better, I suppose I can put up with the same risks as other people do." "Do nothing better?" said Klesmer, a little fired. "No, my dear Miss Arliff, you could do nothing better. Neither man nor woman could do anything better if you could do what was best or good of its kind. I am not decrying the life of the true artist. I am exalting it. I say, it is out of the reach of any but choice organizations, natures framed to love perfection, and to labor for it, ready, like all true lovers, to endure, to wait, to say, 'I am not yet worthy, but she, art, my mistress, is worthy, and I will live to merit her.' An honorable life? Yes. But the honor comes from the inward vocation and the hard-won achievement. There is no honor in donning the life as a livery." Some excitement of yesterday had revived in Klesmer, and hurried him into speech a little aloof from his immediate friendly purpose. He had wished as delicately as possible to rouse in Gwendolyn a sense of her unfitness for a perilous, difficult course, but it was his wont to be angry with the pretensions of incompetence, and he was in danger of getting chafed. Conscious of this, he paused suddenly. But Gwendolyn's chief impression was that he had not yet denied her the power of doing what would be good of its kind. Klesmer's fervor seemed to be a sort of glamour such as he was prone to throw over things in general, and what she desired to assure him of was that she was not afraid of some preliminary hardships. The belief that to present herself in public on the stage must produce an effect such as he had been used to feel certain of in private life was like a bit of her flesh. It was not to be peeled off readily, but must come with blood and pain. She said, in a tone of some insistence, "I am quite prepared to bear hardships at first. Of course, no one can become celebrated all at once. And it is not necessary that everyone should be first-rate either actresses or singers. If you would be so kind as to tell me what steps I should take, I shall have the courage to take them. I don't mind going uphill. It will be easier than the dead level of being a governess. I will take any steps you recommend." Klesmer was convinced now that he must speak plainly. "I will tell you the steps, not that I recommend, but that will be forced upon you. It is all one, so far, what your goal will be: excellence, celebrity, second, third rateness, it is all one. You must go to town under the protection of your mother. You must put yourself under training, musical, dramatic, theatrical. Whatever you desire to do, you have to learn here. Gwendolyn looked as if she were going to speak, but Klezmer lifted up his hand and said, decisively, I know. You have exercised your talents, you recite, you sing from the drawing room standpoint. My dear Fräulein, you must unlearn all that. You have not yet conceived what excellence is. You must unlearn your mistaken admirations. You must know what you have to strive for, and then you must subdue your mind and body to unbroken discipline. Your mind, I say. For you must not be thinking of celebrity. Put that candle out of your eyes, and look only at excellence. You would of course earn nothing, you could get no engagement for a long while. You would need money for yourself and your family. But that, here Klezmer frowned, and shook his fingers, as if to dismiss a triviality, that could perhaps be found. Gwendolyn turned pink and pale during this speech. Her pride had felt a terrible knife edge, and the last sentence only made the smart keener. She was conscious of appearing moved, and tried to escape from her weakness by suddenly walking to a seat, and pointing out a chair to Klezmer. He did not take it, but turned a little in order to face her, and leaned against the piano. At that moment she wished that as he had not sent for him. This first experience of being taken on some other ground than that of her social rank, and her beauty was becoming bitter to her. Klezmer, preoccupied with a serious purpose, went on without change of tone. Now, what sort of issue might be fairly expected from all this self-denial? You would ask that. It is right that your eyes should be open to it. I will tell you truthfully. This issue would be uncertain, and, most probably, would not be worth much. At these relentless words Klezmer put out his lip, and looked through his spectacles with the air of a monster impenetrable by beauty. Gwendolyn's eyes began to burn, but the dread of showing weakness urged her to added self-control. She compelled herself to say, in a hard tone, you think I want talent, or am too old to begin. Klezmer made a sort of hum, and then descended on an emphatic S. The desire and the training should have begun 7 years ago or a good deal earlier. A mountebank's child who helps her father to earn shillings, when she is 6 years old, a child that inherits a singing throat from a long line of choristers, and learns to sing as it learns to talk, has a likelier beginning. Any great achievement in acting or in music grows with the growth. Whenever an artist has been able to say, I came, I saw, I conquered, apostrophe, it has been at the end of patient practice. Genius at first is little more than a great capacity for receiving discipline. Singing and acting, like the fine dexterity of the juggler with his cups and balls, require a shaping of the organs toward a finer and finer certainty of effect. Your muscles, your whole frame must go like a watch, true, true to a hair. That is the work of springtime, before habits have been determined. I did not pretend to genius, said Gwendolyn, still feeling that she might somehow do what Klezmer wanted to represent as impossible. I only suppose that I might have a little talent enough to improve. I don't deny that, said Klezmer. If you had been put in the right track. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.